Anladım. Anladım.
Picture in your mind that you're sitting in a doctor's office after you've consulted experts all over the world. And the doctor says, you need surgery. You need surgery in the next couple of days or else you are not going to survive. And there is no money to pay for your surgery. You're going to need to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars in days or else you're going to be dead. That happened to my guest, Samantha Smith, not once, but multiple times. And I can't wait for you to hear this woman's story of this rare disease and her resilience, her ability to bounce back time and time again from surgeries as well as a disease that should have killed her. This is my guest for Unbeatable, Samantha Smith. Hey guys, before we get into this episode, I want to remind you there are big changes coming up. We're about to replace this podcast with something much bigger and much better. And I have a short video just to describe for you what you can anticipate starting next month. Check this video out.
Hey everyone, today I've got some big news to share. After 3 years of a weekly podcast interviewing some amazing guests, I'm going to make a huge transition. Man, your support to me over the last 3 years has meant the world. But as we move forward, I'm going to replace the Unbeatable podcast, both audio and video, with a television show. You don't have to live in the local area to watch this television show, because the television show is going to broadcast on the internet. It'll be available on Apple TV, on Roku, on Amazon. In fact, I'm launching an entire television channel called Jeff Strucker Ministries. Now, this new venture, it aims to empower lives. We're going to try to inspire people's faith. And I want to continue to try to make an impact, but this new venture is designed to make an eternal impact. And if you'll stay with me, and the entire Unbeatable Army will come with me, together we'll continue to inspire and uplift people. We'll create change that will last in people's lives over a lifetime, and we'll try to do something that will shake the foundations of heaven, that will matter into eternity. I just want to tell you thanks. Thanks for being so loyal to the podcast, and thanks for your continued support. Now, stay tuned for more updates about this television show, about the television channel that I'm creating to replace the Unbeatable podcast called Jeff Strucker Ministries. Can't wait for you to see it as we get ready to launch it in just a few weeks. See you guys.
And now, my interview with Samantha Smith.
These stories of triumph over adversity will help you handle your toughest days in life and become unbeatable.
Hey, Samantha, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to join me for this episode.
No, thank you for having me.
You're coming from across the pond. People will immediately recognize that you've got an accent. Are you living in Manchester right now?
I am, yeah. Yeah, Manchester, England.
There's a question that I'm dying to ask, and really, I want to know, how do you go about crowdfunding almost £750,000? I'd love to know how you do that, but honestly, I don't want to do it for the reason that you had to do it. So you had to raise almost £750,000 just to save your own life, right?
Yeah, that's true. It's not something that I'd ever done before, crowdfunding. I was a complete novice to it, and I can't take the credit for doing it all on my own. I found out that I was very sick and there was no care for me in England, and the care that was available was initially going to cost just less than £500,000 to save my life. And at that stage, I had 8 weeks to do that. Otherwise it would be too late. Basically, I set things up online. I set up a Facebook page, a campaign, and I was very lucky in the way that it took off.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, you became a bit of an internet celebrity. And I don't mean the word celebrity in a bad way. Really, the news started to catch wind of what was happening with you medically. People started to tell each other, but this isn't about money. This is about making people aware of what happened to you. I want to go back and I want the listeners to understand the kind of life that you had before this accident and before you recognized this chronic condition that you have. So describe how strong, competent, successful you were back in 2017.
Okay. So I was 28 in 2017. No, 29, sorry. And I was a single mom of two children, aged 6 and 7. I'm a psychotherapist and I set up two private practices in Manchester city centre at that point. Mostly working with people with various mental health difficulties or, you know, life challenges, traumas. I were also an international best-selling author for a self-help book. And I wrote columns for two different magazines. So my focus was very much being a mom and my work, my absolute passion.
When you're a single mom taking care of two children that have that need a lot of attention, but you're also writing, are you doing that mostly late at night, early in the morning while they're asleep? Is that what your schedule looks like?
Yeah, late at night. So they would see the dad on a couple of the days, one day a week. And when they would see the dad, I would work late in the clinic. So I would see my clients a lot later that evening. And when they were home, I would always make sure that I was home when they were back from school. I would do the mum stuff, get them to bed, and then that would be my time to sit down and write. Yeah. So it was.
I'm trying to make sure that the audience understands. You obviously are a very competent, very intelligent woman to be able to pull off everything that you're pulling off back in 2017, being a single mom, writing, running two successful clinics, takes a lot of skill.
Yeah, I think stubborn's probably a good word to describe
stubborn. Instead of skill, let's call it stubborn. Okay.
Yeah, because I think when I became a single parent, the children were 1 and 2, and I felt that I had a lot to prove and a lot of, I guess, the difficulties I had with accepting becoming a single parent and what I felt that meant about me drove me to I guess prove myself by going above and beyond in my work.
You certainly did. Pulling off an international bestseller alone is impressive. Running a business, not to mention two businesses, is impressive. Doing them both while being a single mom, wow, I'm impressed. But really, the crux of your story is you're in an accident, you're involved in an accident, but from that accident, your health spirals to the point that you should be dead right now. Let's just call it what it is. Can you start talking people through from the time that you were hit by a truck to learning that you have EDS, EHD, I mean,
EDS.
And then EDS. Thank you. And then what it took for you to work your way through that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, I was on my way home from work one evening and I wasn't too far from home. I'd come off the motorway. I was ready to get onto the the local streets nearby, and I was parked up at a red light, and a 44-ton truck, failed to stop and shunted my car forward. And I remember looking in the rearview mirror and seeing how big this truck was, and thinking, "Oh my God, I'm in trouble here." But I got out of the car, I was a bit shaken up, bit sore, but nothing crazy had happened and the car wasn't too damaged and I felt very lucky, very lucky. Walked away from that, went to hospital, was told that I might have whiplash, was treated for whiplash. And then it was about 2 days later, I was living on my own, like I said, with the children, and I had a nap in the afternoon and I woke up from this nap and my whole body was jerking. And it was a really strange, surreal experience because when I did come round, I wasn't quite sure if I was still in, if that had happened in my dream state. Do you know, I was a little bit confused. I had no witnesses. I mentioned it briefly to a friend and then I just dismissed it. I was having a lot of headaches and just strange things. For example, I was dropping my coffee quite a lot. I noticed I was dropping things. So in the house we were living in at the time, I ended up with big coffee marks up the wall because I kept dropping my morning coffee. Yeah. And just strange things were happening like that. And then I had another seizure, what it turned out to be. And that time it was undeniable. You know, I bit my lip, I was bleeding, I was bruised. It was very clear that I'd had a seizure. And I didn't link it to the accident at this point. I went to hospital. They did a few tests and they found something that they thought might be a heart problem. And at this stage, I should probably mention that when I was pregnant with my two children, the pregnancies were in quite close succession. And with each one, I had quite a few unusual health complaints that led to me having a lot of complications during the pregnancies. I was told it was hormonal. I was told it would eventually pass. And I noticed that throughout certain times of the month, after the years after having the children, I would have difficulties like pain in my pelvis. It would slow my walking down a little bit. But nothing that really impacted my life at all, as you can tell from the things that I did. So I guess that was my first sign of having a genetic condition that I didn't quite pick up on and that the doctors certainly didn't pick up on.
Can I interrupt for a second? You're having seizures, you're dropping things. Why do they? Why do the doctors think it might be related to your heart? Because I don't know anything about the medical world, but that doesn't seem like those two are connected.
No. I had had an ECG when I went in following what we thought was a seizure. And that showed that there was a strange pattern with regards to my heartbeat. So they thought that they might be, that was the only thing that was showing up.
I see.
Something might be wrong with regards to
just because of that one test.
Yeah. And so at that point, I was referred to see a cardiologist, but it was quite a while. And in between that time, I just fast declined. I started having these seizures every day. I noticed that if I was upright for any length of time, just being sat upright or stood upright, that was causing it. And when I lay down flat, my symptoms would subside. And eventually what I call seizures, because it would have looked like a typical seizure at that point, became a conscious thing. So I never lost consciousness, but my whole body would be jerking and out of control. This led to lots of strange symptoms. I began vomiting blood, passing blood every morning. My heart rate would go up to and over, even at times 300 beats per minute, and then drop to 40 beats per minute. So I was struggling a lot with my health. And then, long story short, I was not getting a lot of help. I was not getting a lot of support from doctors. The wait to see a specialist was taking a long time. I went to see my general practitioner, and he said that he thought I was overworking myself, that, you know, I'm a single mum, I'm trying to work, I need to just relax. I knew it was something more, and it got to a stage where it was my 30th birthday, so November 2017, I knew I was dying and nobody would listen to me. I say I knew I was dying because I was experiencing paralysis throughout my body. It would last half an hour, 40 minutes if I was upright for any length of time. So it eventually got to the point where I couldn't work because I've collapsed on clients, and then I couldn't find my way home from work. I forgot my children's names.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, my memory was becoming damaged. There was such a wide and vast array of symptoms you know, and I lost a lot of weight. It became very clear that something serious was going on.
Yeah.
And again, I ended up paying to see multiple specialists and wasn't getting any clarity. One doctor said that he thought I might have had a heart attack. Apparently there were some signs of me having had a heart attack. And then I researched a lot online, as we end up doing in this kind of scenario.
Yeah.
And I realized that I was being referred to all these various different specialists, you know, the gastro and then urology, because I was peeing blood, I was vomiting blood, neurology. But I wasn't actually physically getting to see these people because the wait list was so long. And I felt like everything was just slipping from my grasp. And I researched and I became convinced that they must all be interconnected. I mean, it all came at the same time. And that led me to understanding that we have connective tissues in our body, and collagen, most people have heard of. And I began to suspect that I might have this condition called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And that is when the collagen in our body, or the connective tissues, it might be a different type of connective tissue, is made more weakly than other people. So I would have been born with this if that's what I had. And I looked back over my past and I could see strange health experiences. You know, one time at university, I was sat in a lecture and I went blind in one eye. And we later found that my retina had tried to detach, so it had been bleeding, and that blocked my vision.
While you were just sitting there?
Just sitting there. No trauma to the head, nothing to cause it. And I'd had lots of these little experiences through my life where doctors had tried to find a cause, hadn't, and discharged me. And as I looked at this diagnosis online of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, just felt like everything fell into place. And then I went to see a specialist who should diagnose that condition, a rheumatologist, and they told me, no, there's no chance you have this condition, you know, get off Google. And I begged her and I said, I can't leave this room until we get some answers. I'm losing everything. My life is falling apart. And she referred me to a geneticist and said, Samantha believes she has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. I've told her she doesn't. Will you please confirm that I'm right?
Yeah. Would you tell her what I just told her?
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I've done everything I can and she's discharged from my care.
Yeah.
So I went to see this specialist and he said, yeah, you're the most obvious case I've ever seen of this condition.
What? Okay. So I have a couple of questions before we go on. At this point, if I hear you correctly, you're basically laying down most of the time, because if you stand up or if you sit up, you're not stable, might have a seizure.
Yeah. So at this point, I was not safe to be on my own. We moved back in with my parents. I was at times walking. It wasn't long before I was wheelchair bound, and the wheelchair had to hold my head very steady, so we knew there was something going on.
Something was wrong with your neck,
brain.
Too. Yeah.
And I would need to lie down, because if I didn't lie down pretty fast, you know, in different increments, then I would be very, very sick. And so the doctors were witnessing what was happening to me. They could see it was undeniable that something was wrong. But
okay.
Sorry to interrupt. Psychological.
Yeah. So the next question is EDS. I've never heard of it before. How rare is this? It sounds like it's very life-threatening, but how rare is this condition?
So EDS itself, there's multiple types of it. I think at the moment they've found 16 different types that might have recently changed. One type is known as being life-threatening, and that's the vascular type. That's what we would say is the most concerning type to be diagnosed with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the vascular type. The type that I have is called classical, and it's one of the more common types. So we call it a rare condition, but believe it or not, there's more than 1 in 5,000 people who have this condition. Now, the life-threatening part is when we combined the car accident with this condition, that
you just
led...
answered my next question.
Yeah, that led on to my spine collapsing and my skull decapitating, and that's that's where it became life-threatening.
Okay, let's talk about that, because I've never heard of EDS before, but if one in 5,000 have it, then it sounds like it's not as rare as I thought. But I was also wondering, and you've just done the connection for us, what does this have to do with a car accident? Like, why would a vehicle accident have anything to do with a genetic condition? But this is where your story gets intense. And I'm just telling the listeners, I have interviewed people in the past that have had some pretty extreme medical conditions. I'm thinking of the interview that I did in number 79 with Brittany Claiborne, who is a mom who's on her deathbed in the ICU. And she has to have a heart transplant or else she's going to die in a matter of weeks. But those aren't genetic conditions. Yours sounds like it is a combination of anything that can go wrong was going wrong. But when it comes to your spine, I've never heard of anything like this. So you referred to it just a moment ago as decapitating yourself, which for the listener out there means your head comes off. Let's just get into the ugly details of what exactly do you mean by that?
Okay. So when I was told this, I'd ended up seeing a professor in London who suspected, in addition to me having Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, the car accident had caused what's called CCI, or cranial cervical instability, which is the neck issue that we're discussing.
And that, can I ask a question? Is that muscular? Is that skeletal? Is it all of it? There's a problem with your neck and it's not able to hold your skull anymore?
So the connective tissues would be mostly the ligaments and tendons, which are very weak. And then because I'd had like a shunt forward by the truck, that had, as we later found out, that had knocked my vertebrae out of alignment. And my ligaments and tendons were injured in that movement. And so it stretched them beyond repair, which meant that they couldn't hold my spine in position. Like a Jenga wall, really. It just had no stability whatsoever.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah.
Is this where you started trying to, you obviously realized this is life-threatening. This is very serious. At some point, I need to have surgery to fix this. You need to have surgery. This surgery is going to be very invasive, very dangerous, and very, very expensive. And by the way, you haven't been able to work for a long time, so you're going to need a truckload of money to pay for this surgery. When did surgery start to get tossed around in the discussion?
I realized that, oh no. So I got referred to somebody on the NHS in England, and he was a top neurosurgeon, and he said to me, I've never done a surgery of this type on somebody your age. I've done a surgery that requires stabilizing the spine on somebody who's a lot older, who's been in a serious accident, but I've never done it on somebody with your condition or of your age. He discussed the dangers of it with us, and we went away and he said, you need to think about this, but really you don't have much choice. I want to see you on Saturday. And me and my mum went away and we were going to go back on Saturday. And that appointment got cancelled. And we didn't hear from him again. I chased him down. And his seniors, it came out that his seniors had told him he wasn't to offer this surgery to me because he would risk his job if he gave somebody with the genetic condition this surgery. There was a lot that went on inside of that, but I then chose to go to Spain, where I knew the next nearest person was who had done these surgeries and could do these surgeries. And it was in Barcelona where the neurosurgeon sat me and my mum down and said, at the speed that you're deteriorating and looking at these, he did 3D images of my spine, the way it moves. And he said, your skull is hanging on by 5%. So it was overhanging by 95% decapitating. It was blocking my main artery. It was blocking my vagus nerve, hence heart rate problems. And he said, I would estimate at best you've got 8 to 10 weeks to live. Otherwise, you will have multiple organ failure, paralysis, and then death. He offered a surgery, which sounded barbaric. And then he told me how much it was going to cost, which sounded just as bad.
When you use the term NHS for the United States listeners, this is the National Health Services in the UK. Mm. These are some of the most talented medical professionals in the Commonwealth. Mm. But obviously, Spain is not a UK country or a Commonwealth country. And that means whatever happens in Spain is going to come out of your own pocket. It's a barbaric surgery. It's an astronomical price tag. And he just said, you have 8 weeks to live. So you have no choice but to come up with this money and to do this surgery. What was the surgery? And how did you start coming up with this truckload of money?
Okay. The surgery, what he proposed, was not the surgery that I had. But at that point, well, it was done slightly differently. At that point, he suggested that they remove my lower ribs, front and back.
And cut your lower ribs off, is what he's saying?
Yeah. Obviously, cut open the back of my spine and my skull. They would remove a section of my skull. He said my brain stem was being crushed, so they would push my brain back up into my skull to relieve that pressure. And then his intention was to stabilize using hardware, so metal titanium rods, and a bone marrow paste from my own bone marrow, from my hips. So his plan was to use metal, make a bone marrow paste over all of my vertebrae up my neck and towards my skull, and then to stick my ribs either side of that to stabilize it completely so that there would be no movement whatsoever.
So the ribs would basically fuse to the metal rods in there.
Yeah, yeah. To just provide a whole lot of structure to stop me from ever being able to move my head or neck again.
Okay, I'm just sitting there scratching my head at the doctor who has the skills to say, you know, we're going to have to push your brain back into the skull cavity. We're going to have to put some metal in there, and we're going to take some ribs and put them in your neck. But don't worry, it's all going to be great. Like, that kind of medical procedure is mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, yeah, it was to me. And he didn't really say, don't worry, it's all going to be great either. It was a case
of... He probably gave you 20 pages of, here's the problems that might happen because of this. You have one shot at it, and it might... Yeah, you have one shot that it might go right, and here's the 9,000 other chances that it might go wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and the hope was to stop deterioration, so... The risk and the likelihood at that point was that I would never get better than the deterioration that I'd experienced would never improve.
So you would be stuck at this point for the rest of your life?
But I wouldn't be worse. And wow. I would lose all movement of my neck and head.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a very good option. A very expensive, bad choice is what it sounds like you were being asked to make.
Yeah, yeah. It's sad.
Okay, so obviously... You didn't go through with the surgery? Is that what you're saying?
I started to raise funds for that surgery. So the fundraising, that was the plan. But I had my eye at that point on another surgeon who'd been doing these surgeries for a lot longer. And I'd watched all of his seminars online, and he was based in Washington, D.C. And I put him on a pedestal, you know. I started to believe he was the man who could really save me, and he would do things slightly differently without my ribs, what seemed at that point a bit less barbaric. And he had a lot more skills, because you have to think, with this scenario, we're very lucky in this day and age that we have social media. And as soon as I thought I had this condition, I went onto social media and found other people around the world with this condition. And there was two ladies who had recently died having this surgery, who I'd been communicating with. So
they died because of the surgery or during the surgery?
Yeah, both.
Mm. Wow.
So there were a lot of concerns for me with that regard. And I wanted to go to Washington at that point, but I didn't know if my finances could stretch, because that was going to be a lot more expensive.
Yeah. Mm. I did a little bit of research about you, and for the listener out there, just seeing the pictures in the news of what it was like for you when this condition was happening during the surgery, and we're going to talk about the brutal recovery that you had to go through more than once. But all of these were in your attempt to raise funds. But one of the news articles said, at this point, you've got just a few weeks left to live by all accounts, and your surgery options are really bad or worse, but if I don't do it, it's death. And one of the news articles said, this is the point where you decided to start making your own funeral arrangements and deciding who's going to take care of your two children, because it really looks like I am not going to come through this, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Me and the children arranged the funeral. Yeah. It was a necessity and also my way of clawing back some control in a situation where it was not. I wanted to be able to, I mean, as a therapist, I've worked with people who've had traumas, and my whole focus throughout the whole thing was my children, Jensen and Brooke.
Yeah, what's going to happen to my children, of course.
Yeah. And that should they lose me, it would be as smooth as possible for them. It wouldn't have, I mean, obviously it's going to have a massively negative impact on the life, but that I could reduce that in any way that I could, I was going to do it.
Yeah. I've said this on one or two episodes in the past to the whole audience. If you've never sat down and written out or talked to somebody about what you want to happen at your funeral, you really need to do that. It doesn't matter if you're in the prime of your life and there's still 75 more years of life in front of you. Do that, and do that not for yourself, but for the sake of your family so that they know your wishes. But I have been around hundreds, well, actually thousands of guys who have done that. And I know how brutal that is. I also know how difficult it is when children are in the picture. And I'm just trying to imagine what the conversation was like for you and your children when you were saying, okay, I'm probably going to die. Let's talk about what that funeral is going to be like.
Yeah.
And that's a conversation that you'll never forget.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a conversation we had three times over the next 2 years.
You have to raise a lot of money for the surgery. It starts off with a price tag of about £300,000. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
But eventually it goes through the roof, like more than doubles in price. And you eventually ending up raising almost £750 million for it. But what is eventually the surgery that you decide on? Who does it? Where is it? Like, what happens next?
Okay. So the crowdfunding went amazingly, and we raised enough funds for me to be able to afford to go and see the specialist in Washington. So my mom and dad and the children and my little sister, because she's younger than my children, we all went out to Washington. And I saw this surgeon, and he said, you can't go back home. You won't survive. And I need to do this.
You won't even survive the plane ride home, or you don't have enough days left to go back home. Is that what he's saying?
Both. I was not strong enough to go back home. Uh-huh. And he was offering me this surgery that he said he could do the next week. At that point, yeah, I mean, he was adamant that there was no alternative for me at that stage. Yeah.
So you did the surgery in Washington, D.C.?
I did the surgery in Washington, D.C. However, things didn't go to plan. So I was told that as I said before, I was decapitating. In order for you to decapitate, well, in the way that was described to me, it has to be what's your first and second vertebrae in your neck, because those are the ones that are responsible for this movement of your head turning left to right, which I can't do anymore. So, strangely, when I had the surgeon didn't touch that part. I woke up from the surgery and he'd left that part alone. And he had stabilized lower down my spine. He said that he'd noticed the instability in lower down was significant. He felt that was important. And that's what he operated on during the surgery. Only he stabilized a few vertebrae and then he left a gap and then he stabilized a few more. And he also noticed when I was out there that I had what's called tethered cord. So my spinal cord had tried to anchor my spine. It would, in its attempt to anchor me and stabilize me, it had created like a mass and had attached to the bone. So what was happening is my spinal cord was becoming really stretched and damaged, and he needed to release that in the same surgery. So he had to work to release this mass off my spinal cord, lower down my spine. And then he also did the surgery that was different to the one that I'd agreed to have, which was sections of my neck. Unfortunately, the moment I woke up, the first thing I said was, this hasn't worked. Because if you've ever had a dislocation of your body, you know when it's dislocated, you know when it's out of position. I was, before surgery, at a stage where I would just gently press on the vertebrae and then pop them back in place all the way down my neck. They would collapse out. I would pop them back in. You could hear
it. You were physically popping your own vertebrae back in place?
Yeah, you could see it. And sometimes it would slip forward and I couldn't breathe or swallow. It was a very strange situation. And when I woke up from surgery, these vertebrae were not stable.
Wow. You just raised a lot of money. You flew halfway across the country or halfway across the globe. You sat down and did a very dangerous, very deadly surgery. And you wake up from it realizing this isn't it.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I'm just going to tell the listener and then we'll talk about this. You have more than one more surgery before you're actually able to start to recover some of your life prior to the accident, some of your life prior to 2017. Can you describe for us the next couple of surgeries? And I'm skipping over. I don't want to skip over too much, but there's a huge recovery and learning how to walk and talk and eat and find motor skills all over again after one surgery. The idea of doing a second surgery means I'm going to have to, it's going to undo all of this hard work that I've just done, and I'm going to have to do all of that over again. So
yeah.
Can you just walk us through the next couple of treatments?
Yeah, of course. So it was a month later before I managed to convince the doctors that I was genuinely unstable still and I needed more surgery and that the right surgery had not been done. I was taken back down for a surgery then, which added stabilizing the top part just below my skull. And that was, so in between that month, in between them two surgeries, there wasn't an awful lot of recovery. I attempted to recover. I was on crazy amounts of drugs, so many drugs, because we also learned during my recovery, I was supposed to be put in a coma to manage the pain, because the pain, they say, is not something the body can handle. And they couldn't get me in a coma. They discovered as a part of my condition, what they call hyper rapid metabolizer. These drugs don't touch me. They couldn't get me to sleep. They couldn't, the ketamine wasn't taking much effect. None of the pain management was doing anything to me. And within minutes of them injecting it me, as they were leaving the room, my body had got rid of it. Nothing was happening. So the pain was unimaginable.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. So normally they would put people in a medically induced coma just to allow your body to handle the pain and to start to heal itself.
Yeah.
But in your case, that doesn't happen and it doesn't work and none of the pain medication works. So you're going to go through this and feel it on every nerve ending is what you're saying.
Yeah. 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 Every last bit of it. And then there was, you know, changes in medications and withdrawals from seriously high doses of drugs as well at the same time. And then I had the second surgery, which I woke up from, and I was a bit more stable in my spine. Still never felt something was completely right, but I kept being told you need to get used to all this new hardware in your body. You know, you need to get used to the new positioning of your spine. And as you'll know, so the American health system is so very different from the UK one. So that was a shock in itself. I was not used to, you know, having the barcode scanned every time you ask.
Of course, yeah.
And so on and so forth. And that's very distinct awareness of the bill increasing.
Yeah, every time that barcode is scanned, if you're not living in the United States, the bill goes up, and that barcode gets scanned every day, all day long.
Yeah, all day long. The hot water bottle, bar scanned, you know, ice pack, barcode scanned. Everything was. And, you know, rehabilitation, there was only so much that was affordable within our budget because I wasn't planning for this second surgery, which cost another few hundred thousand pounds. And so there were a lot of them worries happening at the same time as I was trying to maximize the small amounts of care that I could afford to access. So I had a couple of days of rehabilitation with regards to telling me how to walk again and tried to support me. And the rest of it was done in a hotel with my family, where we just tried to figure it out, basically. And I had a wheelchair, I had a walker, and we just had to try and wing it the best that we could.
Strictly because of finances, you don't have enough money to pay for the therapy that you're going to need after the surgery.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, that wasn't my last surgery. I mean, it's very hard because it's such a, there's so many stories upon stories amidst all of it. But basically, long story short, I had to come home from America because we had no funds left. And at this stage, I also lost some trust in the care team I had there.
Yeah, of course.
And I came home and felt like an absolute failure. It felt like, it might sound dramatic, but it felt like the world was watching. It felt like there was many, many thousands of people around the world that had tried to save my life. And
it's not dramatic because there are thousands of people all over the world that are not only watching, but they have given some money so that you can get healthy because the news has picked this up. And now your name is being recognized in a lot of places because of how life-threatening this is. So to go home not healed is the ultimate, you know, heartbreak. And I don't mean just your health and your future, but all of those people that had put some of their own hard-earned money into trying to help you get this surgery, and now you've spent the money, but you're not better.
Yeah, and there's another dynamic. There's another dynamic as well with a rare condition, because there were other people around the world who were following my story because somebody they knew needed that same surgery. Somebody they knew was fundraising for that same surgery, and my surgery failed. So their fundraisings were directly impacted.
Yeah.
By my failure, for want of a better word.
If you're not watching her right now on YouTube, if you're just listening, she just put her failure in air quotes. And I hate the fact that you even have to use that phrase, my failure, because obviously you didn't do anything wrong, Samantha. But now you return back to England with not healed and no money.
Yeah. And to no care, because in England, as I said before, there was no care whatsoever. I was on a lot of intense drugs. So I was given enough to come home for a month or two with the ketamine and LSD, morphines, various morphines, oxy, diazepams, benzos, just a cocktail of literally 7 or 8 tablets every hour, 24 hours a day. And when I got back to England, I couldn't access a lot of them drugs. So there was withdrawals, there was systematic changes, you know, there was chaos.
Yeah. Obviously, you can't fly across the Atlantic with all kinds of drugs like that, even if they're medically prescribed drugs in your pocket. And when you get back there, the NHS is not going to approve those kind of drugs. So what happens? How do you finally get the money and the surgery that starts to change your future?
Yeah. I got home and I decided to do a bucket list. I used the next 8 or 9 months to just make memories the best I could with my friends, with my family, the children. That was my priority for a while. I needed a break. And also my body wasn't strong enough for anything, considering surgery, sorry. So when I So we got to the end of 2019, so mid-end of 2019, and I came across somebody on one of these groups who had needed a full revision of the surgery. So she'd had a similar surgery, the surgery had failed her, and she'd found this specialist in Arizona who did this surgery for her. He was willing to fix somebody else's work, and that's really difficult to find. So I reached out to her, and she said, you know, she shared his details with me, and I spoke to him, and he phoned me, and it was just before Christmas. It was 2018. And he said to me, "I've looked at all of your scans." You know, he apologized for everything I'd been through. He recognized many mistakes that had been made in the surgery via the scans. And he said to me, "I can offer you a lifetime fix. You know, I can, it's a big surgery. It's going to be intense, but I can offer you this surgery." And he says, "I would like you out here next week." And that just wasn't, for me, I was enjoying my, yeah, my last Christmas, what I felt, my last Christmas with my children. So I said, "How about January or February?" And he said, "If you feel that you can hold on, okay." So I got off the call and I was over the moon. And an hour later, a bill came through off his team. And I presumed the surgery would be about what we didn't have any
about what you paid in Washington.
Yeah. And it wasn't. It was, if I remember right, it was about $350,000. So again, on top of everything that we'd just done. And it was Christmas time, and I was thinking, everybody's going to be struggling. How on earth am I going to raise that between now and then?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. We did. We raised the funds. And
you, hold on. You raised 350,000 pounds basically in about a month or two. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, over Christmas. Yeah.
During the Christmas season when everybody's already strapped because they've spent everything that they have and more than that on gifts.
Yeah. We were very, very lucky.
Wow.
We raised a lot of the money. I say we because it was a big joint collaboration with people, some people who I haven't even met, you know, huge collaboration. And the media massively supported us. And that allowed me to also gain the attention of a few people who were willing to or wanted to give larger donations to ensure that I reached the target in time. So that was an absolute blessing. And we went to Arizona and it was a completely different experience. It felt a lot more spiritual, a lot more healing the majority of the time. And that surgeon said to me, he said, I'm going to cut open your neck. I'm going to break every vertebrae in your upper spine.
I'm going to break your vertebrae.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I'm going to take out all of the hardware that's already there and clean up everything the best that I can. He says, and then I'm going to turn you over and I'm going to cut your throat and I'm going to insert metalwork also through the front of your throat. So I had hardware through the front and the back of the spine this time to really stabilize it. And he was also decompressing my brainstem and my spinal cord to take the pressure off it. And he said, for every 15 minutes that you're alive, your chance, you know, that I'm doing this, your chance of survival dramatically decreases. And he explained all of the risks and it sounded terrifying. And I think it was a 12-hour surgery that he ended up doing. And when I woke up, I knew that this time it was different.
Yeah. You could feel that you had some stability in your neck when you woke up.
Yeah, it was. I just remember I'd not even opened. I kind of like glanced my eyes a bit and just gave a thumbs up to everybody. I just knew that it was different this time. I felt solid.
This was in February of
2020.
2019. I'd like to spend a few minutes because the news has done a great job of showing the brutal recovery process, learning how to walk again, learning how to talk, learning how to eat. To some degree, you had to learn how to swallow again, if I'm not mistaken. And I'd like for you to just talk a little bit about how hard that recovery was after that surgery. So could you go over that for us?
I think for a start, I think the most important part is the mindset, and I'm probably a bit biased with my work, but I do think it is the mindset. And the difficult thing is when you wake up from such a huge surgery like that is your mind's already been hijacked by all the drugs that you're on. So it's not quite your own, and you're not quite in control of this mindset. However, I recall trying to stand again and feeling so heavy. I mean, obviously losing this movement, I can't look left and right. That's the most movement I've got. And just standing and sitting, my body felt incredibly heavy. So it was a case of really building up towards that, being able to do that safely. I still now, when I get tired, don't quite lift my feet properly and things like that. So, I still have the voices in my head of the physiotherapist telling me heel toe, put your heel first, then your toe. Swallowing, I had to have food that had been blended for a long time. And I had to have drinks that were thickened up until about 18 months ago, actually. Otherwise, I would choke on them. I would
For
aspirate
4 years, basically.
them. The food, I got a lot better quite fast at eating good amounts of food, but drinking was a lot trickier for my body. I would aspirate, so I would be choking, and then I'd get a sore chest for a while. So I had to have them thickened.
So anybody who's watching you right now, on this YouTube broadcast is looking at you. I can't really notice the scars. You had a pretty significant surgery on the front of your neck, as well as multiple surgeries on the back of your neck. I don't notice the scar very much from this distance, which is mind-blowing. It's the surgery itself is mind-blowing. The fact that you can, you don't have huge scars as a result of it is even better. But really, here's one of the things that I know the audience is going to want to hear is things have turned around for you, and I don't mean just medically, but things are turning around for you, for your children, for your family, for your future. In fact, you said right before we started recording that you just got a huge, answer to something you've been looking forward to for a long time. So let's talk about the man of your dreams for a second and what the future looks like for you.
Okay. So I met Martin just before COVID, so not long after we returned home from Arizona.
And you were
And I
still
was
very weak and doing a lot of recovery, right?
still very much so. And then the country went on lockdown, and again, no care, no support. And I would have been at home alone with the children, trying to manage and trying to recover myself, and it would have been virtually impossible. I don't know how I would have managed. And Martin, we took the very unusual leap of him moving in with us, and thankfully it paid off. And then last week he asked me to marry in with the family.
Yeah, hey, congratulations, Samantha. I
Thank
am
you.
so happy for you.
Me and the children are very happy. We make a good
For
team.
a lady who heard more than once, you only have days or weeks to live, and you came through it again and again to be able to have a future, have a, something to look forward to as well as live for. It's amazing. There's a ton other things about your story that I want people to hear, but if anyone is interested in kind of following this journey in far more detail than we were able to cover today, I did a little Google search on Save Samantha EDS, and it brings up lots of Facebook, lots of news reports that show you at various stages along the way. But Samantha, I think one of the things I'd like to wrap this conversation up with is for you to talk to some people out there because you didn't do anything wrong. You didn't ask for this. In fact, it was in your body all along. And had it not been for that accident, you might not have even known it until way down the road. But what you've gone through medically, what you've gone through financially, what your family has had to go through, sitting there and writing out your funeral, thinking, I'm going to be dead, so let's just figure out how this is going to go. And now you're able to be on the other side of it. You've certainly learned a thing or two about life, about hope, about the future. Could you give a couple of thoughts that you've learned to everyone listening?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've put me on the spot.
I did. I could.
I think that when you say that, one of the things that comes up to mind is when I was at my most poorly, and I was living in a back bedroom at my parents' house, and the children were being looked after by my parents, and they would come in and check on me sometimes, but it felt to me like life was going on around me, and I was in this bed and I had a lot of thinking time, and it felt like I was just desperate to figure out how to live forever. I was desperate how to continue in my children's mind and so on and so forth. And I remember saying to my son, when I was very medicated, I said, I found the key to everlasting life. And he was like, what, mummy? And I said, if you do something that impacts other people's lives in a positive way, then no matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, you will continue. You know, the impact of you in your life will continue. And to me, that's the key to everlasting life, which is what I felt I was looking for back then. And so I think that's an important lesson to come away with, is that we can all have a positive impact on somebody else's life. And I think that shows in multiple ways through my story, in the way that so many other people have chosen to help me and they've chosen to support me, whether that be emotionally sharing my story or whether that be financially. Now, I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for that. And because I am, I will continue to have a positive impact on people's lives.
And for a lady with your experience and your background, you mentioned a few minutes ago about the mindset that you used to handle your medical condition and the recovery. And I could not agree more. Mindset makes much more. In fact, in many cases, mindset may be more important than the surgery, the drugs, and all of the hard work of physical therapy. So there's somebody out there who's facing a challenge. Would you give them a piece of advice about the mindset that they're going to need if they're going to go through it and be unbeatable on the other side?
Yeah. I think there's a few things. So we often wait for somebody else to try to save us. And I know that in my case, somebody did. However, it took a lot from me being willing to lay myself bare, being willing to be vulnerable publicly, in order to get people to even invest in me or be interested in my journey and my story. And one of the things which I personally found quite empowering was realizing that there was the only person I could really be sure would do something to help me was me. And so when we are struggling, I'm not saying that we're alone at all, and I don't mean it in that way, but I mean it in the way that the only person we can guarantee will always be with us and will always be there for us is ourselves. And so we have to offer that to ourselves for a start. And secondly, our brain can be our best friend or our worst enemy. And we have the ability.
Totally
and agree. Yeah, I mean, it sounds almost dismissive for me to say, just create a sanctuary in your brain. I know it's not that easy. But that was what I had to do when life got beyond painful, when I didn't want to fight anymore, when I thought I might die because of the pain. You know, I had to create a different place in my mind, a sanctuary that I could escape to, using my imagination and visualization and breathing techniques that helped me. And with the work I do with my clients now, I'm back in clinic working as a psychotherapist, and these are vital tools to help us through anything.
Yeah. And you're not just the lady talking about something you read about in a book. You're the lady who lived it time and time again.
Yeah.
So if anybody's got the right to say it, you certainly do. Samantha, people who might want to know more about you, know more about your story, even connect with you, is there a way that they can learn more?
Yeah. So I'm in the process of rebranding on my social medias, but my page says it's under the name Samantha Lou. Rare resilience, so rare for rare disease,
resilience.
And then resilience. Yeah. My business page with regards to the therapy practice and the coaching is themanchestertherapist.com. So there's two different ways people can connect with me, whether it's to follow my journey, which is the Rare Resilience page, or for support.
Yeah. We'll put links to those pages. By the way, if you're driving right now, you don't have to stop and try to write them down. We'll put links to those pages in the notes. But I also just want to say thank you, Samantha. You've taken a break from interviews for a while. Thank you for being willing to come on this show and to share your story. Because if there is a woman who is medically as well as in your mindset unbeatable, it is definitely you. So thank you.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me. It's lovely to meet you.
You too. I just heard it from Samantha. The mindset makes all of the difference. And the wrong mindset could be your worst enemy. The right mindset could be your best friend. In fact, in Samantha's case, and probably many, many others, your mindset is the difference between life and death. So I don't know what you're facing this week, but I do know this. If you will face it with the right mindset, you have a better chance of beating it. And if you start facing the problem with the absolute wrong perspective, wrong mindset, that's the whole reason the Unbeatable podcast exists. Samantha, thank you for sharing your story with us today. And I want to thank everybody who's tuned in. I've already told you that we're in the process of making some really big changes in the next few weeks. We're going to tell you a lot more details about that coming up soon. But if you're already connected with us, if you're already part of the Unbeatable Army, then please stay connected because we're going to replace this with something even better. If you're already following us on social media, stay with us because what we're replacing this podcast with will be better. If you're not already part of the Unbeatable Army, you can join for free. There's no obligation, and we're also not going to blow up your inbox. Just go over to unbeatablearmy.com. And if you're not already following us on social media, we're out there on almost all of the social media platforms. If you just search for at Unbeatable Podcast, you'll find us out there. And you're also going to find our fan of the week this week. That's Angela Leslie. And Angie, I want to say thank you. Thank you for being connected with us. Thank you for being a great listener. Thank you for the way that you're engaging with other people on social media. That's why we're calling you our fan of the week this week. I hope you've heard something from Samantha today that's given you the courage to say, whatever I'm going through, it's not as bad as what this lady went through. And if she can make it, then I can make it. So thanks for joining me. I'll see you back here next week. God bless.
These stories of triumph over adversity will help you handle your toughest days in life and become unbeatable.